It's a great honor for me to be here at the Empire Club of Canada today, which is arguably the most famous and historically relevant speaker's podium to have ever existed in Canada. It has offered its podium to such international luminaries as Winston Churchill, Ronald Reagan, Audrey Hepburn, the Dalai Lama, Indira Gandhi, and closer to home, from Pierre Trudeau to Justin Trudeau. Literally generations of our great nation's leaders, alongside with those of the world's top international diplomats, heads of state, and business and thought leaders.
It is a real honor and a distinct privilege to be invited to speak to the Empire Club of Canada, which has been welcoming international diplomats, leaders in business and in science and in politics. When they stand at that podium, they speak not only to the entire country, but they can speak to the entire world.
Please welcome your host for today's event.
Welcome to the Empire Club of Canada and to Empire Nights. My name is Sal Rabeni, and it's an honor to stand before our community as chair of the Board of Directors of the Empire Club of Canada. To formally begin this event, I want to acknowledge that we're gathering today on the traditional and treaty lands of the Mississaugas and the Credit, and the homelands of the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. We encourage everyone to learn more about the traditional territory on which you work and live. Our mandate at the Empire Club is to engage and advance the dialogue on what matters most to Canadians. For more than 120 years, we've provided a forum for speakers to engage, debate, educate, and inspire. Today, we bring you an event at the intersection of some of the most important topics for the future: democracy, elections, and artificial intelligence. The Empire Club of Canada is proud to present this special Empire Nights event with a senior U.S.-based communications expert, Sarada Perry, Martin Redcon, political columnist for the Toronto Star, and legendary pollster Don Guy. The event and conversation were made possible through the assistance and support and vision from the dais at Toronto Metropolitan University. Thank you. The Empire Club of Canada is a not-for-profit organization, and we'd like to recognize our sponsors who generously support the club and make these events possible and complimentary for folks to attend. Thank you to our lead event sponsor, Johnson & Johnson. Thank you to our in-kind sponsor, the dais at TMU. And thank you to our season sponsors, Amazon Web Services, AWS, Bruce Power, and Hydro One. We'll be accepting questions from the audience for our speakers. So I don't know if there's a QR code, but if there isn't, I'm sure there'll be someone there looking to gather some of the questions you might have later on. You've probably all read this story. It was all over the news 2 weeks ago. A street musician from the U.S. specializing in card tricks and illusions became famous for performing his most famous trick. He became President Biden. Our magician said he was hired and paid $150 to use AI to mimic the voice of the president. The recording was then used in robocalls and sent to some 20,000 voters to discourage them from voting for Biden in New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary last month. The guy behind this, a political consultant who hired the magician, said he did this on purpose to send a wake-up call on the dangers of AI misuse. This is just a recent example of how AI can be used and how it can threaten elections and the democratic process, a topic of enormous importance, especially in 2024, a record year. More than 50 countries will hold national elections, among them the United States, Mexico, India, South Africa, just to name a few. This will happen in a backdrop of incredibly fast technological advancements that seem to expand the frontiers of artificial intelligence technologies day after day. AI is not new. We've been seeing its potential in action for a while now and during election time, but this is the first time that AI will be tested at scale, as more than 2 billion people will head to the polls posing concerns about the delicate balance between technological advancement and the resilience of democratic institutions. As someone said, this big election year and the use of AI feels like a real-time experiment that is being run on us and democracy right now. Deepfake, robocalls, automated text messages. I continue to be amazed how AI can improve our lives. And by the way, that wasn't meant to be connected, but I do continue to be amazed how AI can improve our lives, boost productivity, unleash creativity, and open doors in science, business, social, diversity, inclusion. And at the same time, amplify misinformation, disinformation, unleash manipulation, and the chaos at an incredible scale. So how can, for example, tech companies, governments, and media outlets find innovative ways to protect the democratic process? How can we ensure that AI and technology are forces for good rather than forces of chaos? These questions and many more will find answers tonight, I hope. As for our US magician, whose voice was used in the robocalls, Paul Carpenter is his name, he said that he was surprised to find out how that recording was used. But something else that he said really struck me, and this has been everywhere in the news. He said, "I created the gun, I didn't shoot it." I don't particularly like the analogy, but it had me thinking of how broad, far-reaching, and also unexpected the implications of our actions have become nowadays. How a $150 trick can reach tens of thousands of people, change perceptions and attitudes, and how important it is not only to try to have some sort of framework and guardrails, but also for all of us at the receiving end to learn how to better deal with this. You know, when we are at home on a Sunday afternoon watching a game and we get a phone call or an email, or when we see something on our social media feed, to stop and think twice before acting on it. We have elections coming up next year in Canada, and so there are many things for us to learn and reflect on. It is now my pleasure to introduce Don Guy, Chief Strategist at Polaris Strategic Insights. Don's research-driven strategies have shaped numerous successful political, public, and corporate campaigns in Canada. Renowned as a legendary political strategist and a policy wizard, his expertise stems from graduate studies in political and democratic behavior at the University of Toronto. Don, welcome.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Sal, and I will just go off script briefly to say that the example of the impersonator of President Biden, I may or may not know, I may have a friend who hired someone at the, and it's, and obviously his passing is a very sad moment for Canada, but at the peak of Prime Minister Mulroney's unpopularity in 1992, I may or may not know of someone who hired a Brian Mulroney impersonator to do a voicemail recording encouraging voters in a certain by-election to go out and support his very good friend, his good, close personal friend, to great effect. So the funny thing is, you know, and really I'm just going to be doing a level set here for a much more important and broader conversation. AI is accelerating our ability to do many of the things we've been doing for a long time, but amplifying them to a much greater extent. So with that, I just want to thank the Empire Club for this opportunity. I'm going to present, since it's Super Tuesday, I'm going to present a soupçon of data for Super Tuesday. Yes, dad joke. this is the place I'm in now. So the first slide is about, and this is hot off the press as of this weekend, is Canadian expectations with respect to the upcoming presidential election in the United States. And there's a couple things that I just want to flag in this in terms of a level set. You know, if you look actually at the bottom bars, there's an equal number of Canadians who expect the Democrats as expect the Republicans to win. It's just there's a much more sizable proportion of people expecting the Democrats to win who think it will be a candidate other than Joe Biden. And then either the Democratic Party or the president himself will come to his senses and perhaps vacate for a different candidate. Whether that happens or not, we'll see. But right now, because of that, just on a straight name-to-name basis, there are more Canadians who think that Mr. Trump will win the election than Mr. Biden, and that has accelerated considerably in the last 45 days. And I think for understandable reasons. Who do you want to see win? You have, well, almost two-thirds, 61% of Canadians say they would prefer that Mr. Biden win over Mr. Trump. More or less evenly split among men and women, which is, I think, a little bit different than what you'd see in the U.S. data. But I will say this. This may feel like a big gap. We saw exactly the same gap with President Bush, exactly the same gap with President Reagan. The Canadians' default position, for whatever reason, seems to be that the Democratic candidate, at least at this stage of the race, is the preference. The difference being, in this case, the majority of current Conservative Party of Canada supporters, so people who say in the next federal election they'd vote Conservative, or People's Party of candidate supporters, a majority of those voters say their preference is Mr. Trump. And that's distributed in different regions. And the only thing I just want to point out, and I think, Sarita, you're probably going to speak to this as well. There is something going on in Western Democratic politics where the Conservative and Progressive parties are swapping electorates. Swapping. And Progressive seems to have become protective. So the people who are most likely to vote Progressive, whether it's in Canada or the United States or in the most recent French election or in the UK or across the Western world, are people who are 50 plus who have done well in life. And they feel like they have something to protect, either gains that they have made or protect on behalf of their children. And the Conservative brand has become deconstructive. And it's appealing to people who say, this is not working for me. It's either not working fast enough or it's not working well enough, and I'm stuck, and I want someone to break it apart and give me an opening, an opportunity. That used to be the Progressive message. It was from, you know, the New Deal forward. It's not anymore. At least that's not how voters are receiving it. And I think that's a dynamic that we probably see in the U.S. campaign. So some things different, but some things the same, and particularly in the way Canadians are looking at their own democracy. You know, if you look at these bottom bars, not a lot of change in the last 23 years on questions of those elected will soon lose touch, and people like me don't have a say in government. And those numbers are more or less the same as they've always been. What's new is there's been growth, and there's been growth particularly in the last, I'd say, 5-6 years in response to a populist message, which speaks to the underlying tone that we were speaking about, of people who think that the biggest threat to democracy is influence of elites. Now, I can make a rational and reasonable argument to you that elites have never had less influence in politics. The politics that we grew up in was very closed door, you know, very few people involved. Frankly, only people who looked and sounded like me. But that's not how younger people are perceiving it. And it's not changing fast enough for them, which is why they're rallying to people who say, it's time to deconstruct that. And I think that is the larger concern for Canada and its democracy as we think about the evolution of our own politics, is that some of these cynical metrics, for lack of a better term, have become more entrenched. And there are new emotions, new feelings that are growing that are causing people to be feel distance from their democracy and the course of their lives, which is really what I think those of us who are involved are really trying to affect. So with that, having had the chance to share that, I'm really excited to get to the part of the program that matters here, which is my friend Martin interviewing Sarada Perry, one of the preeminent political communications thinkers and implementers in North America, who I had the chance to interview 4 years ago, and I was laughing because I got caught in the rain today. 4 years ago, I got caught in a snowstorm. So if you want to talk, is Sarada a force of nature? She causes climactic events just by very virtue being here, but she's also a mentor to people, a number of people that I really respect and care about. And that says more to me about her than anything else. And of course, Martin is a journalist, he's neutral, so he will resent me calling him a friend. But just have tremendous respect for the work that he does as well. So with that, welcome to the Empire Club of Canada.
Thank you for that, the data and for the download. I'm gonna put my little clock here so it's not, it looks like a suspicious thing
it
to
does,
do.
It does, it does, yeah.
Underneath you,
yeah.
But at least I'll have access to that. It's good to be here. Hey, Sarada, do you feel excited about tonight? I don't mean Super Tuesday, but I mean the Empire Club.
I do. It's so great to be back here. Thanks to the dais at TMU for inviting me back to Toronto. It's always so fun. It's always fun to be with you. So thank you all.
So it's good to be back at the Empire Club. I'm having a deja vu of a previous event right after the pandemic where we had another pollster, David Coletto, and another panel and another election. And it was a great event. So this is, it's always great to have this kind of discussion. Dawn gave us a lot to think about. And if you did the thought, if you carried the thought experiment over into this room, I think you'd see a landslide for Biden in terms of popularity and so on. But I think we have to remind ourselves we're not all here to be an isolated echo chamber. We're here because, well, it's a self-selected group. These are political people. I had a look at Dawn's deeper dive, and I don't know if people can access some of the other data that you had shared with me earlier. One funny thing is that 10% of liberals prefer Trump, and 7% of New Democrats prefer Trump, which is proof that you can be mixed up on both sides of the border. And that 7% number sticks in my mind because that's also the number of Americans who believed Elvis Presley was still alive. When pollsters asked in the late 1990s and early noughts, that was a consistent number, which is normal. Like, you can't get everyone in the room. The problem is when you go from 7% to 47% who go cuckoo pops. And then, so we'll talk about that tonight. Okay, so the polling was fascinating, but the truth is we all know none of us gets to vote in America. We're all just watching and waiting and worrying. And so we're looking to you for a pep talk to not preach to the converted, like okay. Not make us, but just tell us how bad things are and maybe how to make things better
okay.
about our democracy, about our discourse, how to arm ourselves against AI and all those things. So we're looking for a lot of answers, no pressure. But let's start with Super Tuesday.
Okay.
No suspense, right? We know more or less what's gonna happen. We talked maybe Nikki Haley do, in or out, how much longer, but the real mystery is how we got here and where we go from here. And so I wanted to start with a trick question and ask, how did we end up with these two candidates that so many people especially independents, don't really like.
Yeah.
Trump and Biden.
It's an important question, and the truth is that I think that this was all kind of baked in 2020, you know? So once we chose those particular candidates, and once Joe Biden was our nominee in 2020, when it became clear that he was not going to say that he would only run for one term, this was kind of inevitable. And so it's funny that everybody has lots of opinions about it and is upset about it, but this was always going to be where we ended up. And to sort of take your question a little bit further, people may say that this is not the matchup they want. Nobody is eager for a rematch of 2020. It was traumatic for everybody. Clearly it was traumatic for you all too. But here we are. And honestly, our country is just so split down the middle that no matter who the nominees were, whoever they were, it's going to be a close race no matter what. And you know, there's all this commentary about one or the other, but it was always going to be really close.
But let me just poke you on that a little bit.
Sure.
Because I think you're right. I know you're right. That we all heard what we wanted to hear from Joe Biden. I'm just running for one term was kind of the body language and the message. But that, as he would say, here's the deal. I'm not leaving, right? And I wonder, is he just still so mad at Obama Biden, at Obama, I should say, that was the ticket. Is he still so mad at Barack Obama nudging him aside for Hillary that he's not gonna leave? Why did we all think he would step aside and he never thought of that?
Well, I didn't think that. And he never said that he would. And
no,
more than that, his presidency has actually been remarkably successful. Right? So we've got record low unemployment. GDP is doing really well. Unlike a lot of other economies that are similar to ours, we have the soft landing post-pandemic. He passed major pieces of bipartisan legislation. He's done a fair number of progressive things. I mean, by many measures, he has had an extraordinarily successful presidency. So just by that measure, you wouldn't think that he would do anything but keep running, right?
No,
and of course, if he were 15 years younger, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
No argument there.
Right.
We all, this room agrees with you.
Right.
We all know that that perception, that metric, performance, is probably the least relevant metric in people's perceptions.
For sure. So Evan Osnos, who's a reporter for The New Yorker, wrote a very lengthy piece that was released this week and included an interview with President Biden. And one of the things he said when Osnos pushed him on this is essentially, look, I'm the only person who's actually beaten this guy in either party. And if you thought that the person you're running against, that if you didn't run, the other person would change the nature of America, what would you do? And I think that he truly believes that he is really the only one at this point to potentially beat Trump. And the truth of the matter is that for the past 4 years, yes, there's a lot of Democratic talent on the bench, but none of it has been cultivated enough to generate the name ID, to generate the lists, to generate the money. As you all know, American campaigns, presidential campaigns, go over $1 billion per side at this point, right? You have to just have an enormous amount of resources. And over the past 4 years, we can talk about some talented young politicians, but they don't have what Biden has.
So there's no Barack Obama waiting in the wings who has made his name at a convention speech. Is there a crisis in leadership, though, where all the wrong people are running and all the right people are running away? Like, why isn't there more? Or why aren't there more Barack Obamas?
I think in some ways that might be the wrong question. I mean, Barack Obama was, of course, a generational political talent. Could he win in an election in America today? No. I think he'd be the first person to say that. Because where we are now is dramatically different from where we were in 2004 when he stepped foot on the national stage in Boston, where we were in 2007 when he declared his presidency, and in 2008 when he won. It's a really different time. But I will say this. I sort of dispute your premise insofar as...
That's what politicians always say to me. Kathleen Wynne, I challenge your premise. Keep going.
Is that there is a ton of talent young talent on the Democratic side. And they actually are in office. We've got governors. We've got some great members of Congress. We've got some great senators. So you're going to see all of that talent continue to rise and make themselves known. It's just that between now and November, is that going to happen? No.
Quick question. Has the train left the station? Is there any scenario, barring a health emergency or a significant cascading drop in the polls, that would change the Democratic nominee?
I don't see what that would be, but I never say never, but I don't see what that would be.
Fair enough. You have, however, given me a good segue into Kamala Harris. So what is the problem there, if I can put it that way? I see, no, but hang on, I didn't mean it to come out quite that way. I see a politician just as I see what you said about Biden's performance being amazing on the bipartisan foreign policy domestic achievement level, and an amazing 81-year-old too, but I see that Americans aren't buying what we're selling here. Kamala Harris seems like an incredibly talented person. What is going wrong with the media coverage of her and the perceptions? Are the media merely biased against her because she's not sufficiently flamboyant, she's too formal or reserved? Is she not a great retail politician? I mean, she did flame out in the primaries. Is there a challenge that is the media's fault, or is a problem with her?
I think there are a few things going on. One is certainly, again, baked in, there is a certain amount of racism and sexism that's just involved in the way that they cover her. We've obviously never had a woman vice president, let alone a woman of color vice president. So that already puts her in a place where she is not going to get covered in the same way had she been a tall white man, frankly. That
My wife
aside,
always says that, tall men. It's just
they're always
not
tall,
fair.
They're always tall. That aside, though, I also think that the vice presidency itself, as one vice president, John Nance Garner, who was one of FDR's vice presidents, said, vice presidency isn't worth a bucket of piss. And you know, that's ungenerous because it can be an important role, but there is no constitutional duty aside being the person who takes office should the president no longer be able to be in office. I mean, there is no set job description.
But the pylon is worse than I've ever seen.
It is really bad, and I think it's a combination of those two things. I think it's a combination of she coming in and not necessarily having a really clear portfolio, mm-hmm. the portfolio being given to her not being one that was popular because it was related to the border, which is the toughest issue that our country is dealing with right now from a political perspective.
Fix this.
I think that wasn't messaged particularly well. I do think that now you're seeing her sort of get her stride because she is focused on a few issues that she clearly feels very strongly about and is very good on in terms of communication. So she's been very vocal and out there on abortion and on reproductive rights, which is a huge issue right now. And she's been doing this sort of college tour, visiting young people, and right now, getting young people back into the Democratic fold, energizing them, is critical to the Democrats winning this time. And they've been really checked out. The situation in Gaza isn't helping. And so she has been really out there on those issues and kind of the progressive voice for the administration. So I think hopefully you'll see more of her stride. But I mean, I agree with everything you've said, that she's just been in this really challenging position. I think it's a combination of everything you said.
So you were challenging my premises before, but now we're agreeing. Okay, we don't have to agree. That's the whole point. So let's talk about the media some more. Let's beat up on the media a little bit. No, really.
just for fun.
Because it's so frustrating to watch the coverage, not just of her, but the coverage of Trump in the American media and the both-sidism and so on. So I guess my question is, you know, in my sneak peek at Don's data and the deeper dive, if you ask Canadians what are the most important parts of democracy, the media is really high up. And then if you ask them about what's threatening democracy or what is a threat that they're angry about, the media are really high up. And so from where you come from as a speechwriter and a communications analyst and a writer, back when you were in the White House and today, because it's changed, the decline of mainstream media, legacy media, the rise of social media, and then perhaps the fall of social media, and the intersection with AI, and the fact that at least the legacy media, most of us have a bit of a filter and a bit of a fact-checking function. Social media don't have that. So it's the easiest vector with Facebook in the last election, and not just fake news, as your friend Donald Trump would say, but deep fakes, which are the other challenge. So where are we at in this intersection of AI, technology, and decline of mass media, the fragmentation, and then the triumph and fall of social media? There's a lot in there, but where do you see the trajectory of AI in this environment?
Speaking to a member of the media, I don't want to criticize the media.
Feedback.
But I might criticize the media. There are, as you said, a few trends going on. First of all, and I think Don's data proves this, or you know, demonstrates this, there's just a general decline of trust in institutions, and the media is one of those institutions. And so already, that alone, not trusting the institution, is a threat to democracy. In the US, and I'm sure that's true here, as you've sort of laid out the considerations, what social media has done is allowed people to take in the information that they want. It's allowed people to sort of bypass the traditional news outlets, and the news outlets are now competing for clicks. And so they're doing and putting out information that is maybe covering Trump, for example, in a way that gets more clicks, because frankly, their business model is fundamentally broken. And it's been broken for a really long time. They lived off advertising dollars for as long as they possibly could, and then social media came and just smashed that model, and they've got nowhere to go. And so from a political perspective, as a political hack that I am, you know, we tell our candidates, you gotta bypass earned media, and you just have to go straight to people yourselves. You have to use those social media channels and target audiences and try to get your message out in your own way. The other thing about that AI that I'll just mention, and we could talk about that all day, but it's interesting that, first of all, the Biden administration, pretty early on, you know, as over the last year, came out with kind of a framework around AI. They got on top of the issue earlier than I would have thought government would, knowing government, right? Mm-hmm. And we all know that government can be a bit sclerotic on these sorts of issues. But they were smart to sort of start to talk to companies and lay out a framework. But the other thing that happened is, I don't know if you guys saw, that was it this week or last week, that you know 20 of these companies, including OpenAI, have agreed to come together and work together to prevent election interference using AI. So I feel like, unlike what happened last time, and I'm not giving anybody a pass or saying that we're all scot-free, we are definitely not scot-free, but at the very least, these companies must realize that the public does not trust them as far as they could throw them, and they need to get on top of this stuff, or they're never gonna be able to get consumers to get, you know, buy into their products. So at the very least, you know, I see some kind of amount of hope there. Not, I'm still as cynical as the rest of us, don't worry, but I feel like we are all aware of what's going on here.
Quick question for the audience. Who here reads the media every day, online, in print? So a very atypical audience, as I said, preaching to the converted here. But here's another question. That was the easy one. Who here, serious question, who here is on Twitter, X, a lot? So not as many as you might think, because people talk about it, but if you go to a dinner party, I never know anybody who's actually wasting their day doom scrolling on Twitter, just journalists and others. Who here is on TikTok?
All the young people.
Okay. And I'm not making fun. I never make fun of TikTok. That's a mistake, because TikTok is where the action is.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
So when you think about the potential, because I mean I think I've hosted or moderated about a half dozen panels on AI. And I'm not gonna say I still don't understand it, because I think I do, which is a dangerous thing to admit or pretend to. But AI is not as complicated as people think it is. It's really machine learning and neural networks and what Don confessed to, and I was tape recording this and with my video, the point is that dirty tricks, bad things have been happening forever.
Yes.
The difference is, and so we had Russian interference in the last election, I guess two elections ago, right? 2016 was the big allegation for the first Russian wave of interference. So bad things have been happening. The difference, as Don pointed out, is scale, right? So it's like spam. Email spam, as opposed to just crank calls or whatever, telemarketing. So I guess the question is, if I could do this over again, I've got ChatGPT to be more concise. But but the question is, are we excessively worried about the boogeyman, boogie person of AI? Or is this at the margins in terms of what will really happen? And the real problem is we don't have two great candidates. How much of a factor is AI? Or do we obsess about it too much?
It's unclear how much of a factor it will be in 2024, right? Specifically in the American election in 2024. Is that the thing I am most worried about? I can't say it is. Now, that might change as we start to see more and more disinformation fueling the election. But we have such other bigger problems, from my perspective as a Democrat, just the general lack of enthusiasm for the candidate I support is something that we can work on. And we are going to continue, you know, the campaigns will do that between now and November. And to me, it feels like if I was going to prioritize, not that I want to, I want somebody to be working on the AI piece too, but I would be more worried about sort of your old school analog issues. Just one more point about AI that I find fascinating. So I don't know if anybody here was following the election in Pakistan, but one of the sort of most popular figures, former Prime Minister Imran Khan, was imprisoned. And so people were using AI to sort of generate images of him, which is just fascinating, a fascinating use, right? And you think about that, that's not quite what's going to happen in the US election, right? But there are all kinds of ways that we haven't even dreamed of that it will be used.
So you had to find a good AI story for me. So
this I don't is know, good
this
or
is
bad.
This is a pep talk.
Good no, or I did, bad, I did but
follow,
it's interesting.
I did follow that.
Right? And
I found that, wow, this is truly terrifying. Because if Imran Khan's party can concoct an AI proxy,
right,
then the military can also concoct
absolutely
an AI proxy
or
an impersonator. So here's the real question. Is AI going to throw me and you out of work?
I think AI will throw the engineers who work on AI out of work eventually.
Okay. Yeah. The revolution needs its children, I guess. Okay. So, Sarah, some of my best friends are speechwriters. I admire their work, mostly, but though I feel their pain. Because
yes,
it is such, it's not as easy as it looks. Writing's not as easy as it looks. But writing for somebody else in their voice and through their brain is really hard. So I know you're tired of talking about this, but I personally, and I hope a few people, would be interested in hearing more about the highs and the lows. Let's talk about Obama first. So everyone thinks he's this magical orator. Does that make him the hardest person to write speeches for in terms of rewrites and demands and trying to get him to stay on script?
Well, you're a writer, so you know that we writers prefer to talk about writing than actually write. So this is great.
Let me just say, though, by way of preamble, that writing's not as easy as it looks because it's not about pretty writing. It's actually, the secret is, it's actually about clear thinking.
Yes.
And smart people don't give us credit for that.
True. So. So with President Obama, of course, he was sort of, again, generational political talent. He will be the first person to tell you that when he first started out, it's not like he was giving these kinds of speeches that were inspiring rooms, right? That sort of thing does take practice. But where he is so talented was that he had done the work to figure out why he is in public life, what his theory of change is, what he believes in, and how that connects to the vision of the country he wanted to build. It was all very clear from that perspective, the clear thinking. In terms of working for him, I mean, it was basically like taking a master writing class every single day, right? Whatever we did was to try to channel the thinking, his thinking, the way he saw the world, and give him the best possible scaffolding so that he could then turn it into what he needed to turn it into, because he didn't have time to write every single speech because, you know, he was running America. And had more important things to do. But I think that actually he was such a disciplined communicator, and so his message and what he believed, you could draw a straight line from that 2004 Democratic Convention speech all the way to the speeches he's giving now. You know, he's been really clear about who he is and what he's doing in public life, and so that actually makes him a more disciplined speaker. You know, it was rare that he would just blow up a speech at the last minute. That's not how he operated. He was much more disciplined
other
than that.
Other people's speeches, not yours.
Exactly. No, all of us. And you didn't see him sort of waver off script because, you know, I think that he respected his audiences enough to think hard about every word he was saying, right? And to not just go off the cuff for fun. Now, he would, of course, ad-lib and he would joke and all that. But he took the time ahead of time to review his speeches and to work with us on them to make sure they were what he wanted to say. And I think that's a lesson for everybody who thinks that they can speak extemporaneously. You probably can't. So prepare and maybe write down what you're going to say, because even Barack Obama does that.
Because some people really are gifted orators, and they are clear thinkers and have a way with words, but their batting average is not what they think it is. So I've listened to some yes. great speakers give really bad speeches yes. where they yes. lose track of the time and just go off on a tangent.
Absolutely.
And it's painful to watch.
Yes.
So how much did he practice?
When I say practice, I would say that he spent so many years out in public life campaigning as a state legislator, frankly teaching, right, which is its own kind of speaking,
yeah.
that he...
Although when you're teaching, because I watched this at TMU, they do have a captive audience, so it's a little
true.
Different.
They have no choice. But as a community organizer, getting up in front of churches and small audiences and just doing it over and over again, that was where he kind of honed the craft and the skill. And then once he was in the White House, very difficult to practice the multiple sets of remarks that you have to give every day. But for the big speeches, the State of the Union, which by the way is this Thursday for President Biden, the big humor speeches like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, he would certainly rehearse.
State of the Union, White House, those are two touchstones.
Yeah.
Tell us a tiny bit about how the challenges for each of those.
Hmm. Different challenges, but similar in some ways. So the State of the Union is sort of, you know, the speechwriter's Super Bowl, except it's really extremely not fun. So there's all this pressure on this speech and the, you know, speaking to a non-American audience. So the State of the Union is technically the president's address to Congress.
And what do we call the Canadian equivalent?
The speech from the throne.
How good is that?
Right? I'm basically Canadian. Please adopt me, please. So the Congress requires that the president give an update, basically, on how the country is doing every year. It does not require that it is a speech. So George Washington and John Adams delivered it as a speech, but Thomas Jefferson, beautiful writer that he was a horrific public speaker. And so he made it a letter. And for a long time, it was just a letter to Congress. Woodrow Wilson comes in and says, I need to build better relationships with Congress. He had been a professor of sort of legislation, basically, and he really wanted to do this. So he turned it back into a speech. What it is essentially the president kind of laying out his budget for the year and his priorities. So by definition, it is kind of a laundry list of your priorities, which makes it a terrible speech.
So how do you, as a speechwriter, make it a speech?
Well, so we always, every year you say, this year it's going to be a story. This year it's going to be it's going to be a 20-minute, you know,
journey
with a narrative arc, and we're going to make an overarching point, and we're not going to get into the laundry list. And then the Department of Agriculture calls and says, I really need you to include this program, and then you don't have a choice. So, you know, our chief speechwriter would work with the chief foreign policy speechwriter, pull together a draft, and then it would be sent to sort of the major advisors, and of course they would have their own opinions, and like any speech, it becomes a process issue, right? Speech writing is 80% self-loathing and 20% process. And so you're kind of trying to figure out, how do I maintain the president's thinking and voice and desire to offer a clear vision to the country, and name check the policies and priorities I need to do, but put them under an umbrella that ties them all together in one vision. So it's an enormous challenge.
How do you do the White House Correspondents'
Dinner? White House Correspondents' Dinner is...
humor is surely the hardest part.
Humor is really challenging. Fortunately, I work for a president who is, in fact, quite funny.
Yes.
And the thing about humor in speeches is that, I think humor is such an important component of leadership, right? It shows a kind of vulnerability. It allows people to connect with you. Self-deprecating humor is really the gold standard.
But it's risky.
But it's risky and it's difficult to pull off. Fortunately, President Obama could largely pull it off. I was never in charge of the process of White House Correspondents' Dinner, but one speechwriter would sort of be in charge of it. And often they would solicit jokes from outside writers, you know? So you'd go to the writers for late night shows and Hollywood writers and just get a bunch of jokes. And you want to get as many jokes as possible. And you'd sort of have broad topics and then start pulling them together. And you solicit as many jokes as possible, hundreds of jokes.
And then make the cut.
And then, yeah. and then you can 100%. Cut from there. And yeah. then you have to sort of workshop them with the president and make sure that they are things that he can actually deliver. And my friend David Litt, who was a humor, did a lot of our humor writing, wrote a book called Thanks Obama. And in it, he tells some great stories about how to do that.
I hear from you that Michelle Obama practiced relentlessly too, including with a teleprompter. Is this, why was she so motivated to, is it because the husband set the bar so high, or what was her thinking there?
I mean, Michelle Obama is a talent in her own right, whether or not, regardless of her husband. I think for Michelle Obama, you know, she did not come to politics. She's the first person to say she hates politics, right? But she does connect with people at a really deep level. And for her, she really understood that she was a role model, you know, that children were watching her speak, and she cares deeply about kids. And so for her, communicating was so critical that she wanted to make sure she got every word right. It was a way of showing your audience that you respected them. The flip, the sort of corollary to this is that during the 2008 campaign, she was often misunderstood, treated really poorly by the press, the subject of pretty racist and sexist attacks. Her words would be taken and then kind of spun and filtered through some kind of lens and stoking the right-wing media. And so she kind of vowed to not be caught in that again. And so she was very careful about her words. And the last thing I'll say about her is I think, and I strongly agree that practicing what you're gonna say and really thinking about it is a way of showing respect for your audiences, that you care about every word. But she also had a way of using storytelling and her very empathetic way of speaking to access audiences that might not otherwise listen to President Obama.
Sarah, some of my best friends do issues management. So I wanted to talk to you about messaging a little bit. And, you know, James Carville famously said for Clinton's campaign against George H. Bush, people forget Ross Perot was part of it as well. Looks like I'm fading out. There you are. But he said it's the economy, stupid. And if that was true, and if it wasn't really Ross Perot who split the Republican vote and allowed Clinton to come up the middle, we do this in Canada all the time with three parties.
Yeah.
Two parties is so much simpler. If it was true, then Joe Biden would be far ahead in the polls, as you were arguing earlier. Unemployment is at record lows, more or less. The economy is doing quite well. I think you would argue that it's not doing well for everyone. So the question isn't, is there a recession? It's about perception. So what is the message that Joe Biden needs to convey? Not statistics. What is the story he needs to tell to try to get through to people that actually, I can do this better than Donald Trump can?
Yeah. I think that, and Don and people who are far smarter than I am can talk to you about sort of breaking down the numbers and what's really going on there and people's perceptions. And we know for sure that the way that Americans view the economy really breaks down by party, right? So Republicans that are in power could be the exact same economy as Joe Biden is presiding over, but they will say it's going well and vice versa. So just everything is really polarized. But I think that what people are feeling is this sense that maybe I'm doing okay. Maybe it's okay, maybe it's not. But I'm not so sure my kids are gonna do okay. I'm not so sure that we are living in a country where the opportunities that were afforded to me are gonna be afforded to my kids.
Okay, but we have that same disconnect in Canada,
yeah.
and we're not electing Donald Trump yet.
So we're not electing Donald Trump yet either. We did boot him out of office. And the people who are definitely gonna vote for Donald Trump,
once.
And there is a ceiling for those people, they, no matter what we tell them, whatever story we tell them about the economy, they are going to vote for Donald Trump no matter what. So for the people who are that the small number of persuadable people, I do think that the story we tell has to be one that is forward-looking. And you're already kind of hearing the Biden campaign do this when they say, you know, when he says, what Donald Trump is doing is just litigating the past, and what I'm trying to do is build a bridge to the future. So I think it really does have to be that, and it has to, people have to believe that, not just that you're fighting for them, but that you are capable of fighting for them, which is why every time Joe Biden comes out and, you know, slips and says something pretty, maybe even profane about Donald Trump, people love that. They want to see combative Joe Biden, because they believe, historically, I believe that Democrats are going to fight for, you know, working folks, although we're seeing a different information on that now. However, they have to believe that he can and that he will. So they want that combat. It's not just about the message, it's the way the messenger presents it.
Does Donald Trump keep reinventing his message? I mean, this is his third campaign, 2016, 2020, 24. What's different between Make America Great Again and Donald Trump today?
Nothing. It's the same message. It's just still very compelling to people. Hmm. He is, however, when you watch, if you can stomach watching his speeches, his rallies, these stem winders, there is a lot of grievance politics mm-hmm. going on. He spends a lot of time litigating the last election, spends a lot of time talking about his enemies. A lot of, you know, every time Nikki Haley does anything, it just gets under his skin and he has to say something. So there is more of that this time. He's keeping a list and checking it twice. January 6th comes up a lot. Yeah. But the fundamental message hasn't changed, and it resonates with his people.
So we all know that messaging is hugely powerful. Tell us about the power of messaging to be bad. I don't mean for society, that's a judgment call, I mean for yourself. So when is messaging misused? What are the pitfalls that people in this room and others need to be aware of? I mean, my own personal problem with messaging is when you send a politician out to sell a shit sandwich, sorry, with a smile on their face, it's kind of inauthentic if you're saying this smells great and it clearly doesn't. So there's a disconnect, a cognitive dissonance in your audience. So in your experience, when people ask you for advice on messaging, what do they have to avoid?
Well, don't sell a shit sandwich with a smile on your face. You know, I've been talking about this week in various settings, but people always are attuned to inauthenticity, but I think now people's BS radar is more sensitive than ever, and that is especially true of young people who just can smell it a mile away. And so if I were advising a leader and a politician in particular, I would just say you are going to have better luck if you figure out who you are, what you stand for, what you truly believe is the project of your province, country, whatever you're trying to lead, and then be as truthful and straightforward about that as you can. I think that one of the reasons people have lost trust in every institution, every single one, is because they smell that inauthenticity. And authentic, as a word, kind of gets a bad rap because in some ways it's associated with Donald Trump. So if we can for a second disassociate those the two, people expect you to be real with them. And I think that if we are real with, if our politicians are real with us, then we sort of take that as a sign of respect, frankly, that they respect us as people, intelligent consumers of information who, you know, whose trust that they can earn.
The Middle East is roiling America, it's roiling Canada. It's something that has grabbed everyone's attention. How is that affecting American politics right now, and Biden in particular?
Hugely. So I don't know how closely folks pay attention, but we're in a situation for the first time, really, where there is a sizable, vocal number of people who are speaking out against the policies of the right-wing Israeli government and really upset about what's going on in Gaza. And what you saw in Michigan, in the Michigan Democratic primary, was that 13% of folks voted uncommitted. Now, as a percentage, this actually isn't all that high. 11% voted uncommitted in 2012 for Obama when he was running uncontested. Hmm. So it's not, Michigan has a history of this. However, it was an organized effort. They made a lot, regardless of the numbers, they helped shape the narrative that Biden is doing something wrong and he's losing progressives. It's not just Muslim Americans and Arab Americans, it's just progressives in general, it's young people. And so they were sending a signal, a really clear signal, that this is not okay. And you're seeing what's interesting. And the Biden administration understands this. It's not as though they are blind to this.
And Kamala Harris has been speaking out specifically
on
this issue.
And so this week she has been speaking out on this issue. And she, you know, from what reporting, accounts of reporting, is that she has actually been on this for many months. You know, she's been upset about this for months and saying this is going to be a problem. And finally, this week, she's been able to be much more vocal about it. But it's a huge problem, and I imagine
was Michigan a warning shot across the bow? or is it something that might actually turn out in November to hurt Biden in that swing state and other states in a way that arguably would be self-defeating if it means Trump is elevated to the presidency?
That is true. So, yes, and I don't think that the people who are voting uncommitted are going to vote for Trump. But the question is, right, when enthusiasm is already the problem, will they stay home? And I don't know. I mean, the answer is I don't know, but it's a risk we can't take. Because in an election that comes down to, 40,000 votes in a handful of states, every single one matters. And so the campaign has got to get on top of this.
You're an American. Some of my best friends are American.
and my big brother as well.
And I have two questions about your American perceptions and situational awareness. One is, as an Indo-American, what can you tell us about the role of Americans of South Asian descent, Kamala Harris, Nikki Haley, others, and their impact on American politics? Because in Canadian politics, it's huge. It's massive, and I've always thought it was much more impactful here, but now that's changing in the U.S. Any thoughts?
From a sort of political elected standpoint, it is interesting that there are more and more South Asians, not just Indian, but South Asian in general, who are running, getting elected. Interesting that we've got Nikki Haley, who's a Southern Republican, Bobby Jindal, who was a Louisiana politician, again, Southern Republican, which is interesting, but plenty of progressives, the chair of the Progressive Caucus in the House, Pramila Jayapal from Washington State, Indian American, so there's lots of folks. What's more interesting to me is actually the electorate. So Indian Americans and South Asians in general, although just proportionate to the population, not a huge number, growing minority, but are starting to find their political voice. Disproportionately Democratic, and it's they're finally, I think, starting to realize that they have some amount of political power, and you're seeing more organizing, you're seeing them raise more money, so it's sort of slowly taking their place, which I think, from that perspective, we're probably behind, Canadian, Indo-Canadians, but you are seeing that start to happen.
So this is not your first time in Canada.
It's not.
And you interact with a lot of Canadians as a workshopping and sharing your wisdom, so you can't duck this
trick
question.
Okay.
And my question is, because we're always watching America and Americans never watch Canada. Doesn't bother us, I swear. but now that you've been here a few times and engaged with politically conscious people, what do you see here that we don't see? About Canadian political culture. What are our similarities? And don't just tell us we're different, better, whatever, you want to be refugee, et cetera. But what do you see as our own weaknesses and danger points that perhaps we don't see? Hmm. On immigration, on diversity, on other issues.
Well, Martin, some of my best friends are Canadian. I think I've been struck by a few things, and I don't think anything I say will be particularly eye-opening for you all. I started coming here regularly, thanks to the Dais, formerly Ryerson Leadership Lab, in 2017, when I really was seeking refuge from my country. But a few things are striking. First of all, conservatives in Canada are what we in America call Democrats. And so it's always fascinating to me to see the political culture here as just, and I could be completely wrong about this, and we're all a self-selecting group here. But I was on a panel with a conservative Canadian last time I was here, and again, his views were sort of far more like the traditional conservative of Ronald Reagan in the United States. It hadn't come full MAGA, make Canada great again. Now I understand that there are, in fact, plenty of pockets of that here, but it was just overall really interesting. The other thing is that I think Canadian values are so palpable, and that Canada has the power to sort of punch above its weight and really influence the world, and maybe is a little scared to inhabit that role. But I want more. I think I want Canada speaking out a little bit more, especially on global issues. I would be really interested to hear more of that. And I've just in individual conversations with folks I've met, I feel like there is much leadership to be had. And your leaders have done that, but I think I want more of it.
Okay.
Sarah and Sal, I think I'm in your hands. I think
we're out of time.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Unless there's room for questions from the public, you tell me.
Yeah, a few questions is great.
Anybody want to
jump in
and fire off a quick question to... Wow. Okay. Viet, go ahead. Fast off the mark.
Yeah, don't let the men get you down. look, I think I wish that we were further along than we are, but we're not. So y'all just need to put on your big girl pants and keep fighting. Find allies. Don't put up with less than equity. And operate with the confidence of a mediocre white man. So own your space, own your talent. I know Canadians apologize a lot. Do not apologize. And remember that you are maybe young, but you're not a child anymore, and the children are looking at you. Every time I am ready to sort of minimize myself or not own my talent or accomplishments, I just remember that my six-year-old daughter is watching me. And I owe it to her and to my son, frankly, to demonstrate that my own confidence but also equity. So those would be the things. And also, let's not forget our sisters who are in much greater trouble around the world.
Can I ask a quick follow-up
Sure.
about confidence?
Sure.
Women and men mm-hmm. who speak publicly, what is your classic advice about the confidence factor for public speaking?
Practice. Practice is what gives you confidence. Everybody is afraid of public speaking. It is something that is nerve-wracking. Speechwriters don't like public speaking. We would rather give words to other people. And yet, at some point in our lives, we will all be asked to get up and say a few words, give a toast at your friend's wedding, or just say thank you at a staff meeting. And we all have to just get better at it, and the only way to get confidence is to practice.
So I should just think I'm better than a white man. No.
Oh, and one more thought on this is that in almost every situation of public speaking, the audience, unless you've done something really bad or it's a crisis, the audience wants you to succeed. People are on your side, so just remember that.
Yeah.
So this is a question about guns in America, and if I had an answer, I would give it to you. I think that he played the role of both, you know, in America, the president is the head of state and head of government, just a unique situation, right?
And so,
exactly, and consoler in chief. So he has to do all these things, and of course, President Obama had a sort of a unique lens of grace and empathy and an ability to do that. However, gun culture in America is unique and uniquely grotesque, as you all know. And they fought, you know, before I was even got to the White House, after Newtown, there was just an enormous legislative push to try to get common sense gun reform. And try as they might, no matter the work of those parents who lost their first graders was not enough to move certain members of Congress who were beholden to the gun lobby, but also a kind of culture in America that just values that. And I don't think any words or messaging would have changed that, right? It's about money and power. And something fundamental has to shift in our culture. I think we're maybe moving towards that place. But if I were to go back, I don't know that I have an answer for how they could have done what they could have done differently.
Okay, one more question from the back. Yes.
I'll just stand. So last year we had the world's largest democracy conducted assassination of a Canadian citizen in Canada, and then we had the FBI and the CIA conduct a smaller operation in the U.S. to fundamentally arrest a diplomat from India because they had evidence that they were planning something similar in the U.S. Away from my AI, naturally, but more of the sentiment of the health of democracy. Why do we think this topic isn't resonating as a threat to democracy when other foreign democracies are actually conducting these types of operations? Do you think there's a message or a resonance there that Americans and Canadians perhaps should care more about when we think about the health of our own sovereign democracies?
That's a good question. I mean, I think most people are not paying attention that closely to those specific incidences. I think we all know that there is a problem with democracy in the world, the rise of sort of authoritarian-light governments, whether that's with Narendra Modi in India or whether that's with Donald Trump in America. So, there is a broader crisis going on. I think that for most people, I want it to resonate with them, but the reality is that that's not where people's heads are. They are thinking about what's going on in their own lives. So the question, and what's going on around their kitchen tables. So the question is, instead of speaking about democracy in abstract terms, how do we tie that to people's actual lived experiences, right? Because it is connected, right? Our fundamental freedoms are at stake, but even the term fundamental freedoms sounds like something out of Thomas Jefferson's time, right? It doesn't actually mean, what am I doing in my life? Can I afford to feed my kids? Do I have the freedom to decide what happens to my body? Whatever it might be. So I think it's incumbent upon communicators and people who want to be our leaders to make those connections for people. It is not incumbent on the public. They are busy, right? So.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Before I hand it over to Sal, I just personally want to preempt him and thank you for the pep talk, and thank you to the audience as well.
Thank you. This was so fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin and Sarada, for your discussion, and Don, for your presentation. I'd now like to welcome Kareem Barghisi, Executive Director of the DAIS TMU.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Kareem Barghisi. I'm the executive director of the DAIS, which my new business card says is Canada's platform for bold policies and better leaders at Toronto Metropolitan University. The bold policies are being produced by our DAIS team, which is scattered around the room, and the better leaders are being produced by our team and are also represented by the front row here of my students from the Making the Future class. Sarada has to go right after this, so can't stay for the networking. But the students from the Making the Future class are here, and they are the future leaders, and hopefully actually indeed the current leaders. We don't necessarily believe in future leadership at the DAIS. We think leadership is being practiced and exercised here and now. I wanted to thank Harsh Bawa, Sal Rabani, and Kent Emerson from the Empire Club and the entire Empire Club team and the Malapart team. For helping put on this event with us. It was imagined by Kent and Mark Hazelden at the DAIS, as well as Kamara Chambers. Mark and Kamara are not here with us today, but are very involved in this whole trip. Wanted to thank Don for his continued engagement in these most important issues over the decades that I've known him. I want to thank Martin and Sarada, who are both senior fellows of the DAIS. This is world tour, or at least Ontario tour 2024 for Sarada. So we're going to Brampton tomorrow for a South Asian women's leadership event, day-long workshop before then. Then we're going to Ottawa and then back into Toronto on Friday for International Women's Day. And it's also the day after the State of the Union address. Also wanted to thank briefly, we've got some advisory board members here of the DAIS as well. Sarada also does double duty on the advisory board, and also Nancy Naylor and the Honorable Elizabeth Dowdswell, who has done who has delivered on behalf of the government a number of speeches from the throne that Sarada referred to earlier. Also, I just wanted to invite you or encourage you to check out the Empire Club has a great list and great series of events. I'm just going to use this microphone for the last few seconds to let you know about Democracy Exchange, which is Canada's Democracy Summit, taking place April 11th to 13th. Kicks off with Wonk Prom, the official after party of the Public Policy Forum Testimonial Dinner on April 11th, and then continues for 2 days of workshops, talks, and leadership development April 12th and the 13th. Early bird tickets are on sale till Friday at the low, low price of $50. And I just want to say thank you for this partnership with the Empire Club and with those of you who have to come to this event. You know, we do this because we care about these issues. And what I love about having Sarada come and share her knowledge, her high-level insights, and then the very tactical advice that she gives to students and to learners of all ages and stages is that it is fundamentally a hopeful enterprise. And however we do this out of a place of perhaps pragmatic hope, but we must be the part of the forces of democracy that are prevailing. So thank you for being part of that in this way today. Thank you.
Thanks, Alfred. Thanks, Karam, and thanks again to our sponsors, Johnson & Johnson, and to the folks at the dais at TMU. As a club of record, all Empire Club of Canada events are available to watch or listen to on our website. I encourage you all to continue and have a drink and get to know one another. And for the students here, thank you for being here today, and I hope you get to meet some of the folks. Our next event is on March 21st. Join us in person or virtually for a conversation with the Honourable Peter Bethenfalvy, the Minister of Finance, in anticipation of Ontario's 2024 budget. I'll just thank you again and invite you to stay for continued networking. This meeting is officially adjourned. Thank you.
Are you both studying policy at TMU?